Guys, we're trying something a little fun and new. We had such a good time during our VR episode interacting with our listeners and getting their best definitely dying stories that we want to ask you guys to share any stories you have with us. So if you have any stories about either thinking you were sick and being wildly wrong, or actually getting sick, or a wild injury story. Basically, if you have any stories you would tell at a party, if it was a party full of people who didn't mind a downer story, give us a call at our Definitely Dying hotline. The number is 323-388-3879. I'll repeat it. And that's 323-388-3879. And you can leave your story on a little Google Voice answering machine. Yeah. And maybe we'll feature it on the show.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be fun?
Wouldn't that be fun? Hello, I'm Madeline Walter.
And I'm Ben Axelrad. And we're both hypochondriacs.
I think I'm sick when I'm not.
And anytime I'm sick, I think I'm a goner for sure.
Welcome to Definitely Dying, the podcast about health concerns, both real and imagined.
Because it's better to laugh about it together than cry about it alone.
I have a runny nose and an ingrown hair. And
my knee hurts.
My armpit kind of rush. Is that a rash? Out and I had Asian food and that makes me feel kind of sick. I might be lactose intolerant. I got a thing on the side of my ear.
I haven't cried in 3 years.
We good? Guys, welcome back to another Definitely Dying. Thank you for being here with us. We just really appreciate you.
I don't.
I appreciate you.
I do too.
I'm the nice one.
That's 100% true. No. That is 100% true.
I need
She's
to reach
nice
a point
and...
in my life where my defining feature is not I'm the nice one. Because I gotta just keep climbing.
No, you definitely do. But you are, between the two of us, you're the nice one and I'm 40. Which I
She's
use as an
nice
excuse
one.
For
He's
everything.
42 people in the world. That could be used to describe so many varieties of sets of people.
That'll be like the music clip that accompanies the RIP picture of our podcast.
The nice one, and he's 40.
He's 40.
This is like a little bit of an older story, but I realized. So in earlier intros, we've talked about my neighbor, my elderly neighbor, Birdie, whose cat, Pierce, I thought to have died. And then we found out that Pierce did not die. He actually survived. Birdie is someone who we've talked about on this podcast. And last month, I had a crazy Birdie experience I just kind of forgot to talk about on the podcast. But I feel like, you know, for all you Birdie heads out there... we really owe you an update. I told this to Ben, but so Pierce, the cat who we thought to have died but didn't, he bit Birdie's foot, and she got. And speaking of cellulitis, which we've talked about on this podcast a couple times, Justin Michael had it. She got cellulitis in her leg and she had to go to the hospital for about 10 days and she came back and she was fine. And then a little while after that, I went to her house because she often will ask me to do little favors. And she'd asked me to take her cat to a free vaccination one morning. And I, even though I had my brothers in town and couldn't do it, I was like, okay, sure. I went to her house and I noticed that she, first of all, she changed her mind. She didn't want her cat to be vaccinated, but her leg was really swollen, her cellulitis leg. And it was looked
was it
troubling to me. Yes, it was
cat scratch fever. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And so her leg was really swollen and I was a little bothered by it. And so I asked another one of my neighbors who sometimes checks in on her. And my other neighbor said that she has been needing to go to the hospital for a long time, but she doesn't want to go because she only likes to go to Cedars-Sinai. That's her hospital. Mm-hmm. And the ambulance that would take her, if she uses sort of Medi-Cal to get there, will only take her to the closest hospital. So they'll take her to that terrible hospital where
Hollywood Press.
Yeah, Hollywood Press, which we've been and it's we had a bad experience.
Yeah.
I would not want to go there. I would not wish it on anybody.
No.
And so I was like, okay, great. This clearly is a sign that I need to take Birdie to the hospital. I talked to her a few times. She has a little bit of a dementia, so it took a few conversations to get her to agree to go to the hospital. But I drove her and And her, a lady who comes in 2 times a week to help her, Miss Marta. I drove Bernie and Miss Marta to Cedars, and it ended up being this like really kind of stressful experience because I went and my plan was to talk to the social workers there to make sure Birdie is getting all of her, like all of her benefits,
right,
you know,
right.
all of her like Medi-Cal benefits that she is owed. Cause like it feels like if this is if she's like, if her leg's swelling up and she's not taking care of it, like something is falling through the cracks.
Sure.
And so like we get to the ER, she tells me to just drop her off, to just dump her like an unwanted baby. And I was like, no. But she, so I had to trick her to let me come into the hospital with her. And I tricked her by being like, I would just really like to see the inside of Cedars Sinai. And so she was like, okay. And so the whole time we were there, she kept asking me like, what do you think? And I kept having to be like, very nice. Girl, lovely hospital. And so we go, she gets checked in, she gets a bed. I talk to the social worker. This like really lovely, nice social worker comes to ask her some questions. And she's immediately being like kind of cagey. Like she's like lying and saying that she has like more help coming in than she does. And then like then when the social worker leaves, she like calls me over and she's like, Madeline, do not tell these people anything. You've already told them too much. No, she says, I fear you've already told them too much. And I was like, what? And I like didn't know. She has dementia again.
Yeah, yeah.
So like some of what she says is legit. Some of it's not.
Yeah.
I immediately felt horrible. Like I had somehow done something really wrong. And I had talked to the social workers based on my other neighbor's recommendation. Like she was like, you know, if you have time, go talk to a social worker, kind of see if there's anything else we can kind of get for her. And so like, I was like, after being at the ER for like hours and hours, I was like flooded with an immediate sense of like something. Like I was like imagining that like Adult Protective Services would come and like cart this like sweet old lady out of her house, put her in like elderly person jail. Like this was a month ago. She's still there. She's fine. Everything's fine. Like we're fine. We're fine. But I remember like we like had a phone call like to talk about the podcast later that day and I was stricken with guilt. I mean, don't you remember?
Oh no, definitely. I told you that I called you a snitch and you did not like it.
No, I know. You very jokingly, you were like, you snitch. And I was like, do you think so?
Yeah. It did not go well.
I don't.
Madeline did the right thing in this situation. All across the board, Madeline did the right thing by Birdie.
I tattled on my old lady neighbor. I am a snitch.
You're not a snitch. I mean, you're old lady.
I'm too by the books.
Well, you know, I mean, I think in these situations, we have to make the decision whether or not adhering to the wishes of this old lady is going to be of greater detriment to her or benefit. And it was clearly she was telling you to do things that were to her detriment.
Yes.
Probably because she herself is to her detriment.
Yes.
She has dementia. And so she doesn't know what's right for her. And it was up to you, somebody who should not have necessarily, should not have had to be in that situation to make a pretty difficult choice on another person's behalf. And the simple fact that you did it puts you in the 1% of good people. I mean, most people are like, look, not on me. My brothers are in town. I'm not taking this old lady to the hospital. And she's dead on the floor, like as Pierce eats her body. You know, like I don't mean this jokingly.
No.
Like, in some ways, you saved her life.
But also, I was thinking, do I want to be a good little hero so badly that I disrupt? This is the thought I had in the moment. I was like, ugh, my desire to just like have a little badge that's like, you're such a good girl. Like that has caused me to disrupt the way somebody fundamentally unconnected from me wants to leave this earth.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, maybe that's bad.
Yeah.
Is that bad? I think it's now that it's all kind of shaken out. But like basically where I landed was like, I don't think I like feel good about making the decisions in that time. And I have also decided to sort of like be, you know, I like kind of like listen to see if she's okay every time I pass her house. But like to try to find a healthy amount of distance, not for me much as for her, because like even though she doesn't have any family, you know, that is in this country at all, they're all in Europe. Like she doesn't need someone posing as the kind of family member that would make decisions that she doesn't want to be made.
Yeah, Well, she can die now if she wants to.
Ben!
Well, no, what I'm saying is that in the moment you made the right decision, and honestly, you lost me when you started mentioning Good Little Heroes, which felt like a TV show that Steve Harvey could host and I would definitely watch. And I think that we should all attempt in our lives to be good little heroes, and then back off when it's not maybe when it's not necessary to. You know, you were in a situation where a decision had to be made in the moment, and it's difficult to make that decision.
Yes,
now, in those subsequent moments, which have been the entire month since, where someone's life isn't in your hands, you don't involve yourself. Yeah. It's not your business.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I think you did a good thing. Listeners at home, write in to Madeline at her personal email address and tell her that she's a hero and a great person.
Tweet at me.
A smart lady.
Please tweet at me and say I'm good.
Yeah, tell Madeline she's good and tell me I'm 40. Should we start the show?
Yeah, let's do it.
Nice.
Guys, we have a lovely, special, cool, fun guest for you today. She has done so many things. She's one of the co-hosts of a really fun new podcast called Kardashian It, which is a Kardashians recap show. I highly recommend you check it out. You can catch her at UCB performing with the excellent Harold team, The Dragons. She works at BuzzFeed. You've seen her on Comedy Bang Bang. You've seen pictures of her looking cool in cool clothes on her Instagram.
Hell yeah.
Can you tell I think she's cool? Guys, this is Jess Jardin.
I'm genuinely blushing.
You're so red.
And now I am too.
Wow, guys, I'm very flattered.
And now I will take it from the top.
Ooh, the shoulders got moving and everything.
She's a one of a kind gal.
Oh, guys.
We're so happy to have you, Jess.
I'm so excited. I've been looking forward to this. I really woke up very pumped. Very excited to be here.
That's great.
So Jessica also is married to a previous guest of ours, Tim Kalpakis from the Birthday Boys.
Yes,
and
one of the things
Tim pointed out in his vows was that everybody loves Triple J, Jessica Jean Jardin.
Yeah,
that's 100% true.
It's really true.
You guys, if you don't love her already, you're going to fall in love with her now.
Yeah.
Madeline, let's spend the next 50 minutes talking about how great she is. Jess, shut the fuck up.
Then you're screaming.
I'm so happy you're here. I'm sorry, I won't do that. I tried. I threw my back out. I'm on the floor now.
Look, the flattery was worth it all. I'm sorry you hurt yourself, but
No regrets. So Jess,
thanks, guys.
We like to kick the podcast off with the same question for all our guests. Let's see how this one fits you.
Okay.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you think about death?
I think about death, I would say 5, like an even 5.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
I think that, like, I would not say I'm frequently thinking about it, but when I do think about it, I think about it. Nice. Do you know what I mean?
Does that make sense? Sure.
Like, so it would, that to median it would be, like, my instinct. But I think that I'm surprised by how much I'm able to not think about it.
Mm.
But then, it'll be more about, like, I think sometimes it'll be like I'll be sitting, like driving on the freeway and sort of floored by like, it's crazy people don't just drive into our lanes.
Yeah.
Like a lot of times it will be about like societal rule adherence. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like,
oh, yeah.
It's crazy people, like anyone could come in and stab me to death here. You know, those are more what I'll be sort of thinking about. Less like, oh, my heart could stop and I could drop dead. It's more about how like vulnerable I'll suddenly realize I am.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Predominantly death, I think I do a lot of not thinking about it. Flying is when I think about it nonstop.
Really?
Wall to wall death.
So you're scared of flying?
I am scared of flying. I am better now.
Uh-huh.
I used to never be afraid. My dad is from Scotland and we used to fly my whole childhood. We grew up flying like long international flights. It was literally never a thing. And then I took a flight. I went to Cabo during swine flu because I got a hot deal.
Oh, yeah.
Is that why you got a hot deal?
Because of swine flu? Gives a deal.
It was I got laid off from my old job at the AV club, which that used to be in LA. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I don't care. I gotta go somewhere.
You
and it was at peak swine flu.
Oh my God.
And
I almost said not pig swine flu.
And then I did. And it was like, I didn't realize why the flights were so cheap. It was like $100 round trip to Cabo, and like resorts were like $100. Like,
that's
no
crazy.
One, it wasn't a full travel ban, but we weren't supposed
to
go.
Right.
And I went, and it was great. And it was an amazing trip. I got to stay in like a beautiful, beautiful room for like no money. But the flight back was on like, cause no one was going.
Oh.
And it was like, truly the oldest plane I've ever been on. It had ashtrays
in
the armrests.
Nice.
There there was like no one on the plane. And it was just like a very bad turbulent flight. But I don't think it was probably even worse than any normal turbulence.
Right.
But the plane was so old that it sounded like it was coming apart. And it was that thing where the pilots never came on and never like said anything. So it was like an empty plane. You couldn't even see. My friend and I couldn't see anyone else within like a head swivel anywhere near us. And this like million-year-old plane. And it truly felt like we were like everyone. When people got off, it was like a crazy thing where people literally were like kissing the ground. And like it was that scary of a flight.
No.
Like everybody was like in tears. It was so bad that my friend and I, we were supposed to go Cabo to Scottsdale to LAX.
Uh-huh.
Is that what the airport is? Phoenix.
Yeah.
And it was so bad that we didn't take our connecting flight and we rented a car and
You're
drove.
Kidding.
Because it was
that
so scary.
Bad.
It was just like, and it happens, but like it like shook my whole brain up.
Yeah.
And like a thing I had never ever thought about became the only thing I could think about, was just like, how does this work? We're supposed to die.
Yeah.
Like just true fear of flying stuff. And it just like snowballed and became like to where it like completely ruled my life. Like I would not take trips and like not go to places. And to where 2 summers ago, my sister, who lives in Dubai, and when she comes to visit, like she has to take like a 15-hour flight to come see us. And she has bad fear of flying for a bunch of other reasons. We took a fear of flying class. Yeah,
I didn't know that existed.
It's crazy. It's called, I'm going to blank. I should plug it. It's like Captain Ron, maybe, or Captain. Uh-huh. He's like it's a fear of flying class that you do out of Burbank airport, and it's like facilitated through Burbank, and it's a 2-day course.
Uh-huh.
And I recommend it to anybody. It didn't cure me, but it helped me retrain my brain. And it's for people who have a like crippling fear of flying. And you spend a day at this sort of like hangar that's adjacent to, actually it's adjacent to this fake plane that they shoot a lot of like commercials and stuff in.
Oh, that's
and
so funny.
You do a whole day with him where he takes you through just like the logistics of like how flying works and like helps you just understand it and understand like the neurology of fear and all of this.
Yeah.
And then you go into this flying simulator.
Yeah.
And you like, and it's turbulence.
Yeah.
And then the next day, which is optional, you are supposed to do a flight with your group. You fly to Oakland as a group, and then you literally get off and reboard and fly back.
Oh my God.
But it's like a regular commercial flight, like a Southwest flight.
Yeah.
And it's all full of scared people?
It's like there was only like 8 people in the class or 10 people.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the plane
is
like normal flight. And they like go on the PA and like you're a bunch of freaks. You're like super freaks. They like clump us all together, and they're like, hey, it's like Southwest. They're like, hey, everybody, we want to give a big shout out to Captain Ron's Flyers. And it's like, truly. And my sister and I were the youngest people by a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
We were the youngest people. And actually, I would say the thing that was amazing and almost helped the most was realizing, like, comparatively, how small our fear was compared to some people. There were people in their like 70s who had missed like the birth of their grandchildren and like their children's weddings and like had truly, truly like their entire lives. And there were people, I would say the starting class on Saturday was maybe like 15 people, maybe like 8-10 did the flying day. And of that, at least 3, I was going to say chicken now. didn't decide to fly. Like at the last minute, one lady sat and like buckled in and was like, nope. And then got off, but was truly crying tears of joy that she had gotten that far.
Oh, yeah.
She had like, just to be on the plane and like sit in it was more than I could imagine. Yeah. And then one lady, or it was like a lady and her husband, and he did it with her. He didn't have fear of flying. They got to Oakland, but they didn't want to fly back. They like rented a car and drove back. But she was really happy that she had done like half of it.
And you can see their faces on Captain Ron's wall of wusses. You were right. It is Captain Ron. It's called Fear of Flying.
Yes.
Did you get the Fearless Flight Kit?
I have the Fearless Flight
What's
Kit.
What's in the Fearless
what
Flight
it?
Kit?
It's basically, it's more, the kit is actually just like a downloadable like audio track that you're supposed to listen to
It's not
when
like
you
Valium
fly.
Or something.
No, I wish. Yeah. I have it. I'm giving that out to everybody. Just here's my kit. Little Xanax.
I definitely want to take Captain Jesse J's.
Yeah, I know. It's primarily
fun with flying.
Yeah, it's crying on a Tim Kalpakis' shoulder. That's primarily what you do during the flight.
Then I've taken that class. I'm going to take it tomorrow, too.
Having your husband say, maybe more wine.
Yeah.
That's it.
Maybe more wine.
Husbands say that. That's something that husbands say.
Well, if they want to enjoy a flight in any way, shape, or form, they might do that. I think that was, there might have been more. I think the kid had like paperwork and like info that you could look at. But it was basically like so that on your own you could like, you know, replicate and remember all the things you'd learned. And so, which I listened to it, but it kind of wasn't that helpful for me.
Like, what kind of stuff is it?
It's kind of like soothing. Like it's funny because it's like, it's just a guy, like a 65-year-old guy. So he doesn't really have the most, like, it's not like a genuinely, it's not like a British woman, like, it's like, Captain Ron wants to remind you, you know, like, it's just a guy talking.
It's like getting on like a Disneyland ride where they're like, put your hats in the basket.
And Captain Ron is a Disney movie, isn't it? Wasn't that a pirate-esque?
Well, I kept trying to think if I was conflating him with Forrest Gump.
Right.
Who's that captain?
Lieutenant Dan.
Not even the same rank.
Yeah.
Not even Lieutenant Dan and Captain Ron. The only thing they have in common is it's a rank in a man's name.
But did we give him a promotion or a demotion? I don't even know which one's worse.
No, I think it's a demotion to handle lunatics that are scared of flying.
Yeah, it said that he was a pilot for 40 years and a flight, I can't remember the term they use, like something basically like flight therapy, fear of flying.
His whole thing,
27 years.
I have his car, like he has a card he gives you at the end, and his whole thing is like literally you can call him and text him, and like anytime. Like
anytime? He's like the Richard Simmons of flying.
Truly. Yeah. It is. And it's, and by the way, he is like his empathy and like his ability, like because at the airport it was like people were fritzing and on the plane and stuff, and like his ability to calm people and like, it like makes me want to cry. He really, really was it was incredible. And it's not cheap, but it was like one of the most, I wouldn't have done it. My sister signed us up for it, and I was like so happy I did it. And it was also just one of the most like fascinating experiences. Yeah. Like we just like connected with people that we would have never crossed paths with otherwise. And really hearing like their sob stories of like how it had impacted their life was unbelievable. Like to just realize like how real it is.
Yeah.
For lots of people. I think that was like an incredibly validating feeling, you know, because you know fear of flying and you know other people, but you're not like sitting on planes trying to talk to people about it.
Right.
And it was just a nice thing to realize like, oh yeah, we like all share this really real fear.
Yeah.
If anything, we've sort of been conditioned to keep it to ourselves when we're, you know, like that thought that like the plane could crash or whatever. Don't say that out loud because now you're inciting a riot essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's
a real thing.
And that's a lot of times what, at least speaking for myself, what makes me spiral is like the feeling of like not trying to scare people on a plane is that, I know that when I see a woman who looks like me on a plane, like crying during turbulence or something, that it like activates my fear and makes it a lot scarier. And so you're trying so hard to be cool, you know, during those, and it's very hard. And so it was just nice to be like, hey, we're a bunch of scared freaks.
Yeah.
It was nice.
I think so much of our fear-based life is trying to keep other people from having to experience the same thing. Or if you're a bad person, just the opposite, like making everyone around you feel it too.
Right.
You know, in the class we talk about don't be the asshole, the one who like that's sort of the asshole kind of move to like make everyone feel your bad feeling too. But in general, I think that's, you know, also in the class we talk about the choking thing. That,
yes,
like, everyone
I always
is so,
think
like,
about that.
What is it?
We've talked about it on this before, that a large percentage of people die of choking because they're too embarrassed to admit that they're choking. That we're having like these intense feelings and then we kind of keep them to ourselves for fear of like giving them out.
Yeah.
But as a result, you know, sometimes the feeling is real and we should be kind of like sharing it, making everyone sort of aware. But in most instances, it's just we're allowing ourselves to suffer unnecessarily.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
not allowing others to help us.
It's a yeah. And I think that. And I'm sort of obsessed with fear of flying in that way. Like, I think it is just like the confluence of everything
yeah.
of like rational and irrational fear.
Yes.
Public space.
Yeah.
An incredibly cramped public space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think everything about it is sort of
yeah.
incredible, you know, and like everything modern happening at once,
yeah.
you know. But yeah. also it is like at the same time. It is a legitimate fear.
It's a legitimate fear.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's not mm-hmm. completely irrational.
No.
You
no.
know?
No. It's not like being like, you know, afraid someone's like listening to you through your walls
exactly.
or something.
Yeah.
Like,
it's
yeah.
like it's to be as someone who has fear of flying. You spend like so much time being like, this is crazy. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then every like 8 months,
yeah.
Like a plane crashes,
right.
and you're like, okay,
it can happen.
Like it is unlikely,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
but there's a difference between irrational and unlikely.
Right.
And
exactly.
I think like to ask the human brain to like differentiate that when it's in like a panic spiral mm-hmm. is really hard.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting to me that like that basically it was like a door opened in your brain when like you experienced whether it was actually close to a plane crash or not, you experienced what to you was basically a plane crash. And
mm-hmm.
it's like one of those doors that you can't unopen. Like
and that
realizing
became,
that, viscerally realizing that's possible.
I mm-hmm. think that was the, because I didn't know that could happen. That
yeah.
you could be so, like to where I had spent so much of my life up till my late 20s
yeah.
watching people be scared of flying, hearing people talk about it and being like, God, that sucks. That's
yeah.
such a bummer.
Yeah.
What a bummer for them. I do not relate on any level
yeah, yeah.
and literally just like oscillating to that exact position and being unable to relate to my previous mindset in
yeah.
any way, shape or form.
Yeah.
Like to realize how much of life is about just like, you don't choose to be blissfully unaware.
Right.
It's
no.
just like the state that you have been lucky enough to exist in.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then that, and I think that happens all the time to people who've been like robbed or like
yes, to, yes.
when things happen and how much it just changes all the kinds of ways that can change just
yeah.
your like day to day mindset. And I feel fortunate that it's like, flying is essentially not something I do that often.
Sure.
So it's like manageable
yeah.
and it's been a thing that I can like figure out and remedy over a long period of time as opposed to like, oh, my day to day is ruled by this,
sure,
you
sure.
know?
Yeah.
But it's that same kind of thing where like you just suddenly can't not think about
no,
it.
No,
yeah.
no. How are you, Madeline, for this for, mm-hmm. for you too, this is sort of a general, I don't think we've talked about
yeah.
yet on this. How are you affected by the Ariana Grande Manchester thing? As some like as, you know, I've become somebody who's a little bit afraid of being in like these sort of mass public settings.
Yeah. I you know, I think that was interesting to me because it taps into like and I'm sure this relates to flying stuff too, but I'm claustrophobic, like deeply claustrophobic.
Have you always been?
Always. Always, always, always. And like I have a very hard time with like big crowds as it is,
yeah.
especially
yeah.
concerts, like they're already like, and I, and yeah. it's a weird thing because I'm also social and I really
sure.
like being around people and I like big
yeah.
events, but that they already kind of bring out like a
me
lot
too.
Of anxiety
yeah.
for me. So I think that to me is terrifying because it preys on like, I mean, everything about it is terrifying, but yeah, it's like that's a fear that I wouldn't say like rules my brain very often.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm able
mm-hmm.
to put that at bay. The idea of like, an attack,
yeah.
I think, doesn't come into my mind as often.
I've noticed recently that it really is affecting me. Like like yesterday I went to a 3:15 showing of Wonder Woman
mm-hmm.
on a Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an afternoon showing mm-hmm. on a Wednesday. Once I was fairly certain that everyone who wanted to see the movie
yeah,
had already
yeah,
seen it,
yeah.
and there would be no one else.
I didn't see it either.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We should all go. Yeah.
It's a good movie. Okay. I liked it, but yeah, I scanned through because now you can pick your seat at the theaters and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went to an unpopular theater. I went to the iPick Theater in Pasadena. No one go. No one can find the iPick Theater in Pasadena.
Is that the one with food?
Yeah, food.
Like
recliner
fancy.
Chairs. Yeah,
yeah,
it's nice.
Yeah.
And I went by myself. I picked a showing that had no one else attending it. Because it's like, why are they coming for me?
Yeah.
they wouldn't. and And then I got there and there were like seven other people in attendance and I felt anxious and I put the blanket on and I fell asleep. And I woke up in time. Usually when I go to those movies, like Rogue One, I got maybe 10 minutes in and
you
then I was out like a light.
I hate to say it.
Really, really good. Tim sleeps through all movies.
Hanford 2. Yeah. We're much older than we are, than our ages would depict. But yeah, no, I just in all of those instances, like I can't see my baseball team, not my baseball team, but the local team from Detroit where I'm from, the Tigers. I don't know why I'm acting like no one's ever heard of Major League Baseball.
From the town that I'm from.
Yeah.
Just a $500 million franchise that no one's heard of. My team came to town and I thought about going to Anaheim to see them play. And I was like, I'm not going to go to a giant, like a massive stadium full of people. Two, I'm not going to go to a massive stadium full of people and be the enemy, the one who's rooting for the other team.
Yeah.
But just in general, like I found myself like wanting to be around people that I trust and never wanting to be in group settings where I can't control the outcome.
Yeah. I think, though, to be honest, I think that's very rational. And I think to me, that's like, I think there's something like Darwinian about that. Like the amount of like variables that are in like a huge crowded event, you know, like I think it makes sense to, as we get older, to be like that would start to produce more and more anxiety.
Yeah.
Not only just because as you get older, you like less people.
Yeah.
And people become a lot harder to just be around generally.
Yeah.
And you just want to be around like the people you like more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think part of me thinks that that's like kind of a natural like progression mentally.
I think so too.
You know?
And to some extent, I think that, like the fear that someone would come and blow up that place is really just the icing on the cake. Like that it's like the final straw that pushed me over. In the same way that like fear of sharks is a rational thing. Like if a shark, there are sharks in the ocean. But the thing is, there are a lot of other dangers in the ocean. And so if you compile all of them together and sharks is just the final straw, then we think to ourselves, oh, I have a phobia of sharks. No, the ocean is terrifying and sharks are in there and it pushed you over the edge. The fear of someone exploding a movie theater is super terrifying. But I'm also just sort of, like you said, like afraid of strangers and afraid of like being in group settings and afraid of hot air and baseball.
And people just bullshitting you.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of blowing steam at the baseball game.
Well, I think that that's, I think about that a lot, that's like there's something just very... I think you can't be too punishing on yourself for that, you know, because like even also there's a layer of it that I wonder. I never checked if this was true or not. But with fear of flying, I remember reading, I think I read it with my eyeballs, but it was saying that like it is common for women in their late 20s to develop a fear of flying out of the blue because it connects to hormonally part of like us preparing for motherhood and the idea of like needing to stay alive, truly no idea if this is very true or not, but like this idea of like you are hormonally shifting in the same way that you suddenly have a biological clock and you think the way that your brain chemistry is changing, it also connects the idea of like a survivalism that you didn't necessarily have at 20 and 21.
Right.
And like, so part of me feels like a lot of fears could be connected to like the literal, it's not just our brain playing tricks on us as much as it's like, we can hormonally be shifting like in terms of our evolution and like what we're supposed to be doing at that point in our life,
Makes
total
sense.
Like to be in large crowds in our like mid 30s and beyond, there's a likelihood we like have kids or that we need to stay alive and we think about things in a way that we just don't when we're like 19.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I think throughout our childhood and adolescence and really up until probably your late 20s, a lot of life is just coming to terms with the fact that you're not invincible and that your parents are not invincible.
Yes.
I think that's the early one, is just realizing like, oh, my parents can't actually protect me and I hate them for that, you know?
Yeah.
And then kind of coming to terms with it and learning to love them again. But like at first just sort of being like, you brought me into this world and you can't do anything to ensure my safety. Like nothing. Like you're weak.
You're weak.
You're afraid of flying, mommy.
Shaking them by the shoulder.
Yeah. Oh, I gave my parents a pounding.
You made little fists.
Pow.
No, it's true. And I feel like, though, having that realization in like a weird way has made Oh, this is really dumb. I'm about to say something dumb. Do you ever read? I really love one of my fave self-help authors is Brené Brown. You ever read any Brené Brown?
No.
How do you say that first name again?
That's my girl. I love her.
Brené?
Yeah, B-R-E-N-E.
Like Brené, but with a B.
Exactly. Oh. And she like writes a lot about like vulnerability, like her. And like one of the books that I read of hers that was like, I think right before, like she recently got like a little bump of popularity because she like did a TED Talk. And then Oprah was like, I love Brené Brown.
That'll do
it. But she has this one book called The Gifts of Imperfection. And it's like this like teeny little book. It like doesn't look cool. It's like before she was really popular. Yeah. But it's my favorite book of hers. And my friend who is like a psychiatrist, like, you know, and just like is really smart about all these things. Yeah. She's like, this is a great book. You should read it. And she talks about a lot of cool things. You should read that book. But one thing that she describes is the idea of happiness as, I'm like cringing as I say this because it's just like such a sad old wine lady's like description. But like she's like a helpful image for her of happiness is like a string of like twinkle lights or Christmas lights.
I could not relate more.
You know? And like just like realizing that like the goal in life is to not be just a string of continuous lights, you know, like you can't, like that's how you go crazy.
Yes.
But like it really is just this string of twinkle lights where you got like a bunch of wire and then a light and then another light and, you know, and striving for that as opposed to being like, it should be lights every day. Like, you know, it's like helped me realize that like, you know, like these like tragedies that will happen and these hard things that will happen are like not, they're like not an indication that life is bad or wrong.
Yeah.
It's just what life is.
Yeah.
And
I think accepting, I think like coming, I would say a huge part of like my development with like fear and mortality is trying to like respect and come to terms with randomness.
Yeah.
You know, just like, and it's a lot easier if you are like not religious, which is, I'm not, I never have been. So it's like already there, you know, in a certain sense where there's no explanation for anything as it is.
Yeah.
Right.
But that, like to sort of assume that like, A lot of everything is just a lot of randomness.
Yeah.
And that like there's a certain like freeing lack of control, you know, and that, which is hard, I think, for most people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But that and that relates to like, flying on a plane or any of it, you know, and that is like primarily like in that example, that's what I'm like screaming in my head at the top of the flight is like. There's no, you have no control.
To
literally say that over and over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just like suffer, like so much of like the suffering that we inflict upon ourselves is thinking we should be able to control the things we do.
I like spiraled a little bit a couple weeks ago. And this isn't like, I would say my normal like MO, but I found it like I got to a freeing space, but there was, you know, I was like clicking around in the news in the morning and some, you know, Voodoo Donuts in Portland.
Yeah.
Famous donut place, and they I guess have some competition, like one of those kind of like weird eats kind of things.
Oh yeah,
where it's like if you can, I think they have like it's like a giant donut, like some huge. Uh-huh. It's either a giant donut or how many donuts can you eat in a window of time? I think it's like they have the famous giant donut.
Yeah,
and it was like some, you know, they get lots of tourists, and some tourists were in there at like 1 a.m. and probably had like been out, and a guy choked to death, and he died. Like he died, and I couldn't stop thinking about it because I was like. It's like there's a million deaths like that, you know, but that are just like, you thought, like, what a death.
Mm-hmm.
Like, life is
just.
Choked
on a donut.
He choked on a donut and died. And it's not, there's nothing even particularly, like, funny or insane about it. It's just sort of like the true randomness of just like, that's a death. Like, that was it. That was it.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
That's all.
You're
and
done.
Like I don't feel like I get like hung up on those kinds of stories very often.
No.
But for some reason that one like really stuck in my craw and I like it like ended up opening up a portal of my brain where it was just sort of like, hey man, I guess you gotta just do the best you can.
Yeah. No, totally.
Because any day you could just choke on a donut.
Yeah.
I mean, true, like you gotta really enjoy the nice times.
That's true.
Cause you never know.
I don't know. And that's like, I feel like when I say those things to myself, like, hey, life is short. Mm-hmm. Hey, like as a person with a lot of anxiety and stuff, it's like, yeah, I'm saying it, but I'm like, I'm never really thinking that. I was talking about this with, I work with Dave Horwitz, who we're all friends with. And we were talking, I don't know if this is applicable or this connects in the way that you mean it, but like we were talking about that there's that app or that website Nextdoor that's like neighborhood.
Oh,
it's like a neighborhood app.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you sign up for like I'm on the like Los Feliz Nextdoor.
Yeah.
And I had like heard people talk a lot about it and like, oh, it's so cool. You like find out about all this local stuff and like you learn about your neighbors and like, and it is this like really thoughtful, cool, built out app. But I realized, like, as I started checking in on it, that it was like all about like scary people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Or I saw it's a lot of like, it feels like a lot of shut-ins.
Yes.
But it's a lot, which they're not, but it's a lot of people just being like, I just got a bad vibe about this guy walking down the street.
Yeah.
And some of them are very legit.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
It's like a guy was outside my window. And some of them are real.
Yeah.
But the more I was on it, the more I was like, I am going to lose my mind because this like preys at like everything that I am pushing out of my brain all day.
Yeah.
And I know that I need some of this information.
Yes.
But as I weighed it out, like against like the day to day anxiety, it was like activating in like my safest of places, which is like the little bed I sleep in.
Yeah.
It's not that little. It's like but it's like
King?
My
little. Great. No. Queen?
But it's a Tempur-Pedic queen.
Oh,
so.
Oh, nice. Okay.
You win some, you lose some.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I was like, I like couldn't stop thinking about it because I was like, I feel negligent, like not looking at this because some of it is like, there's a peeping Tom on your street.
Right,
you know
right,
that.
Right.
But I was like, I like got rid of it because I was like, I am choosing. I don't. This like activates too much and caves. It like caves in the roof too much.
Right, right, right.
On like how I can participate in the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
That's half the thing, and it's 100% I'm in agreement. The other is just like the other. This is the best that I can describe it. Death is the one experience in life that we're not going to go through, that everyone else is going to go through our death, but we're not going to go through it.
Yes.
And I just wonder, to some extent, if your consciousness creates a reality in which you survive whatever thing actually is taking you out of this world. And there's no basis for it.
Yeah.
It just sort of keeps me calm a little bit in certain instances where,
that.
The older I get, the more I fear not understanding intentions, you know, or Jess and I have talked about this thing that we're both a little bit afraid of dogs.
Yeah.
And the reason being that, like, I mean, for me, I can't speak for you, but the reason for me is just that that there's nothing, if a dog gets angry at me, there's nothing I can do to talk it out of that, of its, you know, its desire to bite my face off or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's like a big fear of mine. And so the ability to go into a world in which I'm not going to be able to control certain outcomes that are going to be, that will be conditional based on, interactions with other people. I can only control my side of the interaction or whatever.
Yeah.
It's been helpful for me to engage in those situations now that I'm in a situation where I have to spend more time with strangers. But because of the class, I have to now, I wasn't interacting with people that I wasn't very trusting of prior to this.
Yeah.
And it was starting to like wear on me a little bit. Like this idea, you know, in the class, I have to give people the door code to get into the place where we teach.
Yeah,
and I was feeling fear of giving it to someone who would go on to be like, you know, who would grow angry at the class and then kill us all, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure like it's, you know, I'm sure like a lot of it has to do with the current president and that like that a lot of, you know, just in general, be it, you know, political or fatal. I think there are a lot of thoughts that we're aware of that are now like really creeping into our consciousness.
Yeah.
I also think like in the case of your class, it's interesting to me because it's like you also, if you are prone to feeling anxieties in the world and especially absorbing other people's, like I think it's similar to like if you teach and coach improv and stuff, like if you're that, I always describe it as like if you, there's people I think who are kind of more porous, right? Like you absorb, like that's how I feel about myself, you know, like it's like you can really like take in a person and take in like their energy and it all sounds like very like kind of like, it's hard to articulate, but it's like you, another person's energy can really like seep into your skin. And so I always kind of like visualize it as like just being very porous. And it's a big part of why, like, I think it's what aids in like amazing creativity and great improv.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
like you can sort of bleed into each other in this great way and makes you a great teacher. But you also like absorb a lot of like, you're also talking about people's like deepest fears. And for your class, especially like their greatest anxieties, their greatest insecurities, and you're they're absorbing that, yeah, like the second you meet them, and only more so, and yeah, in a wonderful way, but also in a way that can be like, I imagine, draining, you know,
yeah, definitely,
that it's
definitely,
like, and that you are, and that if anyone sort of has like flags or feels a little off or you don't connect yeah, fully, like I imagine that probably would yeah, activate a part of my brain. That's like, you feel this responsibility, especially as the teacher. Like I would have it with improv coaching, yeah, a lot, yeah, yeah, which yeah, is just like, I would sometimes feel like I wanted to just like walk outside and like gulp air, you
yeah,
know, like
no,
you
totally,
feel a person's yeah, like need and anxiety and life just like sitting on your chest,
yeah,
you know?
I think that's, I think you hit the nail on the head that like overcoming that, there was this feeling that like, I don't know how to say it exactly in terms of like my response, yeah, but the sort of the umbrella to it would be that like, you can't help someone if you fear that they can hurt you.
Yeah.
And so overcoming my fear that they could hurt me enabled the class to help them in a way that I just sort of managed the class, but that the class is
sort of
a
You do a lot more than manage.
Thank you.
Ben is an amazing teacher.
Thank you. But anyway, sorry, Madeline, I cut you off.
Oh, no, I was just, I mean, I was just going to kind of like agree with that.
Yeah.
But I also have a question. So
yeah,
you said a couple times you're a person that has a lot of anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me more about that.
I think I have
Tell me
like,
too.
Not just me.
Ben, whisper, could you go outside?
Can you just whisper it to me? Just tell me.
Girl talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say I have just like very classic anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, the original formula. I think I think I'm like a lot of people where it was like a thing I didn't identify for a long
yeah,
time. And in fact, it was like in my early 20s, I was having like more like stomach stuff. I had like irritable bowel and
yeah,
went to my doctor to talk about it. And that's when she was like, started to ask me a lot of questions about anxiety.
Like what kind of questions?
Like she was basically just like, I was like very confused because
yeah,
I was like, we're going through all my like, you know, poop stuff.
Yeah.
And she's like, so talk to me about like your, what does a day feel like for you? Like, how often do you think about one thought? Like, do you feel things like feel circular in your mind? Are you able to let go of things?
No.
Yeah. And,
yes,
and it was
yes,
just like,
yes, no.
It was all questions like that. And I was really confused at the time. And then she was like, you know, she was like, look, especially for women, which
yeah,
I found interesting, we carry our anxiety like in our stomachs and in our like lower, basically our bowels. Like,
yeah,
that's where it sits for lots of people.
Yeah.
But she was saying at least more so for women. And so she was saying that like she actually treats IBS and a lot of like, you know, stomach and indigestion issues with anxiety medication, which floored me
yeah,
at the time because I was not. It never occurred to me, and my parents are very like, they've been on and off medication. They're
yeah,
like, they're very, very open family. We all do therapy and
yeah,
everything. It's very like acceptable, but I had just never been like, oh, I'm a person with anxiety
yeah,
until that moment. And
yeah,
so she was like, let's put you on anxiety medication and see if it clears up your IBS. And it did.
Whoa.
It also was like too strong. It was Klonopin. Everybody
oh,
reacts very differently.
Yeah, Klonopin
like,
makes you fall right asleep.
I
yeah,
don't sleep at a
yeah,
bar. My friend was like, can we talk about your medication? I was living with the time because I fell asleep at a bar.
It makes you too
it's so
sleepy.
It's just sleep pills.
It's not, yeah.
But it did immediately clear up stomach stuff. And so
whoa,
that was like an amazing experience for me to realize like the interconnectedness
yeah,
of our bodies, especially.
Yeah.
And so from there, I would say I began a journey of trying to figure out like, you know, she had been like, take a Klonopin every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I became someone who was like, or was like, that's too much. And
yeah,
so there was a lot of like fine tuning
yeah,
with her. And what I've ended up with is I have a Xanax prescription
mm-hmm,
that is technically for fear of flying.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and there was a time when like I would take it like more regularly or take, but I'm very affected by it. So a lot of like,
yeah,
it almost looks disgusting. Like if you saw my thing, there's like nibbles out of them, you know?
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
A little
one,
pill?
Yeah.
Will like knock you out.
Because I can't, they're too small to break. So it's like, it looks so, it's like very.
It's like a bunch of rats got into your Xanax.
Honey, I shrunk my anxiety.
So gross. Whenever I pour them out of my hand, I'm like, ugh. Like, it's so gross looking. But a whole one is a
that's
lot
so
for
funny,
me. Like, I will take
yeah,
a whole one for like a flight.
Yeah.
But in like a day to day.
This is still Klonopin?
No, this is
okay,
Xanax.
Like, oh, Xanax.
So
okay.
I think I did Klonopin. I think there was another one in between. Maybe like Ativan, which is also
yeah,
too strong for me. Xanax, for whatever reason, is a good fit, but it's not something I don't want to be medicated every day
yeah,
if I can.
Sure.
And it's no judgment against it, but it was just like personal. emotionally, it can fog me out a lot. So where it's landed is that, like, I, you know, because a big thing I realized that blew my mind with anxiety was that if it's in my purse, it literally changes everything.
Yes. Which I think knowing that you have the power to, like,
it's unreal. It's, like, how much if, like, my prescription runs out, which is, I don't know if that's a positive or a negative, because it's still a dependency in a certain sense.
Yeah. Mm.
But it's, like, how much I would realize, like, just the physical being of it, of having it is night and day for
me. Totally.
That's night and day. So I would say, like, in general, I'm not, I don't really take it, but that, like, I have it. I take it for flying. If I'm having, like, a particularly anxious day for some reason, I try to, like, think about it first.
Yeah.
You know, because I've also done a lot of therapy.
Sure.
And that's the, I think the key part personally is figuring that out. But I'll try and actually, like, take myself through it, you know, really, like, what are you anxious about? What is it? What is the root reason?
Yeah.
Is this something that you've worked on? Are you trying to actively, or are you just like, I'm anxious, you know, that feels not what I want to do. I certainly do, but, like, to try and see it through and understand, like, what is my root anxiety? And most importantly, is this recurring?
Yeah.
Am I doing anything about this? Is this, like, a relationship in my life? Someone I'm seeing very often and every time? Because there's people in my life, like, I have to take this before I see them because our situation is complicated. And so to me, it's like, okay, like, it's almost by having the, taking it is when I'm like, the physicality of it, like, puts a flag in it for me. Like, this is a thing where when you go do this thing, you get anxious. Like, the act of, it surprised me, I guess, the physicality of just having anti-anxiety medication, how much that actually feeds into just, like, being aware of your anxiety.
I mean, I think, you know, listen close, Trump administration, the access to health care means people don't need it as often.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's there and available to them is often enough to placate.
It's so funny because my doctor, twice now, I've been like, I'm also very self-conscious of being perceived as, like, you know, an addict or something.
Yeah.
And so twice now I've been, like, called or been in the office and been like, I do need my Xanax refilled. I just want you to know, I'm very literally, I'm like, I can see how rarely you refill this. I'm looking at it. I don't think that. I'm like,
you're fine.
I mean,
yeah.
There's no judgment. I mean, I would. I mean, I would tell you if I needed more, but I don't. Like, which again is like literally talking about my anti-anxiety medication is like activating my anxiety.
They should just give you one cookie-sized Xanax that you can just take little bites out of.
One of those, like, big kid lollipops.
Yeah.
Or one of those regular
jawbreakers. You remember those big jawbreakers that you have for like 6 months in your sock
drawer? I keep pulling
drawer.
That out of my purse. Yeah, I'm at like Betsy Amano's party and feeling a lot of anxiety. Excuse me.
What if they gave you a shot? What if it was just a regular cookie, but the chips were Xanax? Would you eat something like that? If they were like small?
If it worked with my dosage, 100%.
I would do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say that's sort of like, I think that if you're a person with anxiety, it's sort of like, there's not really like a solution as much as just like anything. It's like, I think of it a lot, like I'm also someone who has back problems and back pain.
Yeah.
And it's like fascinating because when you go through, it's like the Louis episode, you know, when you
go
through and you've done it all in MRIs and you talk to a bunch of experts, it's like you basically get like a, this is your life now.
Yeah.
You know, like I got a fancy MRI and they were like, I was so scared. I was like, oh, it's going to be surgery. It's going to be all this stuff. And then they were like, yeah, you're getting older. So this looks normal for a woman your age. And I was like, oh, and that reality, I think, can be hard. But there's also something like I'm more used to that now.
Yeah,
that it's like a lot of life is about like there's no solve that will wipe this away.
No.
And ultimately, it's just about like, how do I manage it?
Yeah.
And being
yeah.
aware of like what my management plan is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big deal. Having a plan. It's like when it's like they say, you know, they tell your family to have like an escape plan for if there's a fire. That much of life is just like knowing how to react when. And something kind of goes outside of your control or at least outside of like your immediate control. If you have a plan of attack, you can survive it.
Yeah.
But in that moment, danger is present and you need to know how to react to that danger.
Yeah. And I think like separating out the pieces of like what's what, you know what I mean? Like, I think that's a big part is like my therapist speaks a lot in like pieces, like which is a thing that I love so much, where I'll like barf out a big thing of like something that's on my mind or a bunch of a big crazy thing happened. And she'll be like, so I'm hearing a lot of different pieces.
Oh, I
hear this
that.
Piece and I hear this piece. And her whole thing is about like, and I think everyone does it, which is just like how much we conflate everything is one, you know, like our family anxiety is our relationship anxiety is our career anxiety.
Yeah.
And they are all interconnected.
Yeah.
But like if you have that luxury to try and like pull out and identify, like, and I literally see them almost like a Trivial Pursuit pie piece, you know, like what is what and like how can I kind of squarely identify what about this relationship or this situation?
Yes. I complete like crazy. Like I'm trying to like think of like an example that's like even interesting enough to say, but like I'll be like, gosh, I'm trying to think like I'll do something like I will like get an audition for like a Wednesday afternoon and then like I'll be like I'll go through this whole thing of like, okay, I'll have like maybe like dinner plans and I'll be like, okay, should I like keep these dinner plans or should I prepare for this audition? Yeah. Because I feel like, okay, if I keep them, maybe that's like improperly prioritizing like my social pressures before my career. And then if I get in bed a little later, that extra, like I'll like think on like true 15 minutes of sleep. Like, and I'll be like, that will make a difference between me like doing well and doing not well. And what that really means is that like, I'm doing a poor job of like fulfilling my commitment to myself. Like, you know, it just turns into.
And it generally turns into being mean to yourself.
Always.
You know, that tends to be like the inroads all lead to like, you're bad.
You're bad.
It's tiring.
Yeah.
Because if you decide that you're bad, then you don't have to do anything. Yeah. Then you can just be like, oh, well, I don't have to go to that. It's okay when I don't get that, when that audition doesn't work out because I was bad in the first place and I'm no good. But Madeline gets the auditions.
I never let myself, I don't even let myself like sulk. I'll be like, I'm never even like, you're just bad. I'm like, you didn't like you didn't do what you should have and you could have done better. Yeah. And now like you don't get to even have the liberty of feeling sad
about
something.
You don't get to feel
like,
sorry for yourself.
No,
not
you
feel
mad
yourself,
at yourself, not sorry for yourself. Yes. And then you like, you know.
Because one involves a kind of indulgence essentially.
Yes, exactly.
Even though I think a lot of times it's very justified, you know.
And like sometimes the nicest thing you can do for yourself is like feel sorry for yourself for a second.
Yes. Yeah. To just let it happen and then you can let it go.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Instead of being like, you could have prevented this.
That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. I hear it all the time.
Sorry, go on.
This is like our first Definitely Dying fashion segment. Because
I'm so honored.
I know. Yeah, I mean, we really felt like we wanted to do something fashion related.
One of the threats among your subtuple is you're a fashionista.
Yeah. You always look so cool.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you that's so nice.
And everyone in the community comes to you for tips.
I'm very flattered. There's a fun bit that's been going on for years where Mary Sasson publicly asks me style questions.
I see those.
And
it's
those,
my
favorite
thing in the world.
I just saw that thread about a maxi dress.
Yes.
I saw one about mixing metals.
Yes. There you go.
And actually, I saw the watch that she was thinking
great
about
choice.
Buying
oh,
yeah. as a result. Like, that question inspired, and it's
she
a great
it.
Watch.
She nailed it. She's got great taste.
It's a great watch. Maybe off the pod, I could. I'm looking... I'm like thinking about becoming a watch person.
I think Mary's really leading the charge.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm not a watch person, and I saw Mary's and I was like, I might have to get a watch.
I think I want to get a watch.
I think they look beautiful on like, especially on like a woman's arm. Anyways.
I know. Right. I know. I want to get a watch.
Do it.
Anyway, this segment is about the clothes that people are buried in.
Burials. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got very curious and I looked up, just like, you know, I Googled actually several times different iterations of the question, what should I be buried in?
Yeah, yeah.
So if somebody like looks up my Google searches, they'll be like, you okay?
The answer was pudding.
I support that.
And so I didn't find any like definitive rules, but I found a long guide on a website called funeralhome.net.
Sounds very legit.
And they brought up a couple interesting points.
I'm realizing as you're beginning this that I have never thought about there's probably specific stuff you can and can't do.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, well, and also just specific, more like specific. Okay, so basically funeralhome.net.
Big shout out.
Yeah, big shout out.
To our friends over at Funeral Home. So what if that was like a huge sponsor? They like wrote you guys a huge check.
Funeral Home.net, your one stop shop for just general funeral info.
And stamps.
Stamps.
And books.
So they wrote this long article. I'll summarize it. Basically, they were saying like there are no rules, but they were making the point that you could almost make no more important decision than what to bury a loved one in.
I get it.
then they told this story about a man who chose to bury his father in overalls because he was like, my dad loved to be casual. He like hated to dress up. He wore a tie all the time, or he hated to wear a tie. And so I want him to be buried in what he I think maybe died in, which is a pair of overalls.
Oh, no.
And then so like funeralhome.net was like, flash forward months later, this man apparently thinks about it every day, and he can't let it go because he realized after burying his dad that his dad has two ties that he would wear that they had recently given away before his dad died. And he was like, because I remember my dad always saying, you it's disrespectful not to dress up for a wedding or a funeral.
Oh,
and
no.
So now he's haunted by the idea that his dad, who like
cared,
thought it was so gauche to like, you know, show up without a tie to a funeral, is buried in a pair of fucking overalls.
I like the way that he worded that, had this guy haunted by his father in overalls.
Yeah.
Like if you bury a loved one in the wrong fashion item, they're going to come back and
in
haunt you
outfit.
In that item. Yeah.
That is so, yes, of course.
And I have to, I just want to read one quote from this article because I think it's like, funeralhome.net really puts it interestingly. okay. They also made, just sidebar, they made the point that, that like kind of cremation is the same. You can like even though they're not being buried in them, you can like cremate people.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. An outfit would also, it's so much weirder to just be like, stick them in nude.
Body.
Yeah. Except then you'd find like there'd be like bone chunks and then like a button.
I guess you have to make sure metals are gone. There's also this whole thing of when you're, because I also found some forms that you fill out for a funeral home for what this person should be buried in. And there are boxes for like, this should be removed after a viewing and kept, or this should actually go into the ground. So like a nice piece of jewelry you might have on somebody for like a wake, and then
but that ultimately they want to give to the granddaughter afterwards. Yeah. Okay.
It's like
that's interesting.
Weird
a whole extra step, of course.
Yeah. But funeralhome.net says, quote, to assume that written instructions or a lack thereof are always best adhered to may be, in fact, making a mistake. It's best that no one person be asked to make this decision on his or her own, and that all involved in the decision take the question very, very seriously.
I love the drama of funeralhome.net.
I love
the writing is rich.
It was really like a medium style essay. Yeah. the clothes that a person will be buried in are the very image that all the world will have of the person for eternity.
The world. All right.
and in case that's your thought, the article goes on to say, the point from the last section cannot be stressed enough.
Oh my God.
Even experts in the field of psychology and grief counseling will warn families that if they find themselves not consulting one another carefully on this matter of what to wear in the grave, they may be putting their emotional well-being at risk for many decades.
That's so random.
This is the thing I've never
thought about. Mm-mm. I guess I've also like I've never been to an open casket funeral.
No, me either.
Oh yeah.
So I'm sure that affects it. Like once you've like thought about it, once you've had a moment of seeing someone you know in a casket.
As I was thinking about it, that like because I've told the story on this podcast before about going to my grandmother's funeral, and you know I live here, and she died in Michigan, and when we went home to see her right before she died, we didn't necessarily know that this was going to be the last time, so we didn't, you know, you don't necessarily pack like funeral clothes when you're just going home, and so we didn't have funeral clothes, and so we had made this decision on behalf of those who were mourning that we would all. My grandma was like a huge Detroit Tigers fan. That's the franchise that plays baseball in Detroit. I know
that
no one's heard of them.
Small
town. Your town's baseball team.
Just a little league team. And so my grandma was a huge Tigers fan, so we all wore, and I had written like a little sort of narrative that that combined like her last days with a little tiger story that it was actually, you can read it online if you ever want to. It was published on the Detroit Tigers Sports Illustrated site.
Whoa.
It was cool for my family. What was I saying? So we all decided to wear these tiger t-shirts, and it was really nice. We bought a bunch of tiger shirts and tiger hats and stuff, and like everyone was adorned in this this memorabilia that felt like it would make like my grandma really happy. And then I was thinking about it like after the fact, and like my grandma still had to wear like a kind of a shitty suit. I was like, we didn't even let her have the fun.
She was overdressed.
Aren't you going to be haunted by that for decades?
For decades and decades. We put grandma in her dress overalls. She wouldn't have liked it. But yeah, it did occur to me as like, this attire is determining how it is that you're going to react to the, like, what kind of event this is off. I mean, in the same way that, like, if you tell people it's a black tie wedding, it's a more fancy one than if you tell people to wear, like, you know, luau shirts and you go to the beach. Yeah. With Jessica's wedding was actually a combination of those. And it was a great wedding.
I'm going to have a black tie luau funeral. Why not?
Why? That's my question.
Idea. Okay.
This is like, not to be morbid, but it's just to make the question more like current. Like, mm-hmm. if you were to sort of die at this general age, I'm not asking you to make a guess about what you will like when you are an elderly lady.
Great. Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's helpful.
What would you request to be buried in?
Oh my God. What a good question. You know what my first thought was?
What?
Which I wouldn't, it's not real, was like, because I'm too scared in real life to wear like a two-piece bathing suit.
That's great.
I'm just like, hey, there's a moment to be bold force everyone to just deal with your body when you don't have to deal with it, like free of all anxiety.
Yeah. No, that's true.
That's the best possible answer. I love it. In a bikini.
Like, just like, finally got the guts. And everyone like comes up to the casket and they're like, she finally did
it. She looks really good.
She didn't even do the high waist. It's not even the high waist bottoms. Yeah. It's a full regular bikini.
I'm going to go
classic bikini.
Good job. Classic bikini.
I'm going to go with swim trunks and like a wet, oversized white t-shirt that suggests that I wasn't comfortable with my.
I think it was Dragons. Who was it? Or maybe it was Dan, but we were joking about how, like, because it's everybody. I used to, wear t-shirts in the pool and stuff and joking about the idea. Or maybe it was that Big Grande was going to do a sketch that was like everyone at a pool, like teenagers or preteens pool party, and the guys have those shirts on. It's like, it's crazy how he probably has huge muscles under there. Isn't it crazy how buff he probably is under that shirt? That is like my favorite visual. Like a bunch of preteen girls being like, think about the muscles that must be under there. It really works.
That's so funny.
That's great. I like that look.
The best answer I could think of.
What would you wear?
I don't know. I see. It's like, I feel like I have a lot of dresses that I'll wear to a lot of rehearsal dinners. Like, I have this one blue dress from Madewell that it's, I can't say I feel excited when I wear it, but I know I look fine.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look disrespectful, but it's not too flashy for a wedding. And I hate to think that that's how I go out. But I think also that's probably what someone would opt to bury me in, because they'd be like, she wears that dress. Anytime a picture is taken of her, she's usually wearing this one blue dress. And so I might just make it easy, not have you try on a bunch of things on my dead body, and you can just bury me in that.
Well,
I imagine.
Right? Certain stuff may like lay weirdly. I don't know.
So you could bury me in that.
I would love to see that montage style fashion show, but with a corpse. Yes. Like the music plays and they keep pushing it out of the dressing room.
I imagine if you wanted to do, there must be older women that want to get buried in like caftans and like loose stuff. And it's probably very easy to just look like a weird fabric burrito or something, you know?
I wonder if anybody gets buried in their wedding dress. I mean, you never get to wear.
I bet you it happens. Yeah. I bet you it happens frequently.
Yeah.
Especially if it's like older couples and maybe like the one half died, they never got over it, or they never, that they're like, got over it. Jesus Christ.
I was just thinking about how bad it probably fits.
Yeah.
Well, you're laying down so the whole back could be open.
That's
true. You just have to basically drape it.
Yeah, just lay it on top. Big bikini underneath.
What about you? What would you be buried in?
Like, legitimately, not the oversized t-shirt and my swimwear.
A soaking wet oversized t-shirt.
What would I get buried in? Probably a suit, because I think I look best in suits.
Yeah, you do.
And
you
look good in suits. As opposed to like, otherwise, like everything I own, like I was talking to someone recently, and they were convinced that I only owned four T-shirts because I just wear four monochromatic.
But I
actually have more than one.
Yeah,
I have like I have four of these black shirts, for instance.
I think that's the right
dark
way to
blue.
Live.
Yeah. Yeah. So otherwise, everything that I have is dark and monochromatic, and it seems like neither flattering or unflattering. So like I figure. The last look of me should either be, I don't know. I guess it depends if you want me to look my best. I mean, it depends how I go out, you know, like if I turn out to be the monster that everyone envisions, I'm going to be just maybe bury me in flames. But if I turn out to be an okay guy, better than a lot of people expect, then give me a nice, nice dark suit.
Well, you guys, speaking of going out, as we go out of this podcast, do you want to anything you want to plug? Jess?
Oh, well, you guys so kindly did a lot of good plugging before.
That's what we do.
To plug.
It was great. It was like a whole bunch of sockets. I would say give a listen to. I have a Kardashian themed podcast, like you said, with Trisha McAlpin and Marcy Jarro, who are two of the funniest ladies in the world. And even if you don't like Kardashians, it's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Come on out and watch The Dragons. We're usually at Mondays at UCB Franklin. And I don't know. That's probably it.
That's great.
Great.
You guys,
thanks
you guys did it. I don't want to start blushing again. I make myself blush. Sorry, I just realized how crazy that is. Go on, you. No, that's it. This was so
great.
Fun. You guys are the best.
You're the best.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been Definitely Dying. Thank you guys so much for listening.
Don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes, and you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Definitely Dying.
Until next time, stay healthy.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.